Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to strategypage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Jim and Austin. Today, I thought it would be good to talk a little bit about Russia and what Russia is doing. You know, it's always hard for me, and I'm sure it's hard for both of you sometimes, not to refer to them as the Soviet Union, since we all grew up during that time. And, you know, Jim and Austin, you guys longer than me. But, you know, I was studying in college about the Soviets. And so that was one of my emphasis was on defense issues. And it's like all that went away. But it almost is like they're coming back, right, Jim?
Well, yes and no. Yeah, you know, I should point out that in my How to Make War books, the first one came out in 1981, I made a point of calling the Soviets Russians. And I said in the preface that, you know, the Russians will be around a lot longer than the Soviets. I also went into, in one section of the book, an analysis of their economy, which many Western economists had been looking at closely. And I've been getting into arguments with my friends down at the CIA, because they'd occasionally call me and to ask my opinion on, you know, what I thought the balance was and how the economy was working. And I pointed out that the numbers don't add up. Now, this sounds very much like, you know, what happened was when a quant tried to explain to the SEC that Bernie Madoff's, you know, fund did not make any sense at all. It was a very similar situation. But the people at the CIA, many of them agreed with my numbers, but they said the political position in Washington is that the Soviet Union is going to be there for a long time. So when dealing with the Soviet Union, you know, you can't ignore what people want versus what is. Now, what the Russians want is their old world-class weapons development and production capability. That went away in the 1990s when all the money went away. I mean, they basically had to declare bankruptcy. That's what forced the Soviet Union to collapse. They were sort of like a super Greece, spending money they didn't have. And what happened that they only recently admitted was that although they kept many of the organizations developing and producing weapons together, mainly by aggressively exporting weapons to China especially, because they offered China not only bargain prices, for much better stuff than the Chinese had at the time. But basically look the other way as the Chinese stole a lot of that technology. Now, as the Russians are getting more into exporting high-tech weapons, they're finding that all the best people have left the defense industries because there was much more money to be made either outside of Russia or increasingly inside Russia with non-defense companies. And they simply can't get the quality of people that enable them to not keep up with the West, but to at least be competitive, shall we say. I mean, they did produce the Su-27 at the end of the Cold War and the MiG-29, although the MiG-29 turned out to be a real turkey. And the Su-27 still hasn't been tried in combat, so one does not know. But still, it looks impressive as hell, and that counts for something. But in so many other areas of military technology, they just have not got it anymore. As we've reported, the problems they're having with their Bolava, you know, SLBM, sea-launched ballistic missile, even they, I mean, we reported it first, and then a year or two later, the Russians were saying, we've lost all our best people. Well, welcome to the real world, pal. The Russians tried to ignore that for a long time, and they couldn't. So you're seeing more deals, like just recently in the last month, they signed a cooperation deal with Israel, military technology transfers from Israel to the Soviet Union, initially in the area of UAVs. And by pure coincidence, after they signed that deal, the Russians said, oh, we're not going to sell, S-300 anti-aircraft missiles to Iran. At the same time, I think only this week, they made their deal with France to buy four Mistral, you know, amphibious assault ships. Two of them will be built in France. The other two will be built in Russia with accompanying technology transfer. Of course, just having Russian shipyard workers build a Western warship like that will impart a lot of technology. And what the Russians have been doing with a lot of their military technology, I mean, some of it is still competitive, like the Mi-17 helicopter, which is breaking sales records. It was always a reliable helicopter, but in the last 20 years, the Russians have imported a lot of Western manufacturing technology and techniques. They can be competitive in a lot of areas of manufactured goods now because they have the techniques that always existed in the West. And so the Mi-17s, which were always fairly reliable, are now actually fairly safe. Even American, you know, high-ranking American officers will fly in, you know, Afghan Mi-17s because they're not red-listed anymore as aircraft, you know, VIP should stay away from. So while they're catching up, they basically pretty much lost, any chance of regaining a competitive capability in high-tech military stuff. And they're hanging on or even increasing their capabilities in mid-range, you know, stuff, you know, like helicopters, not high-tech stuff, but just meat and potatoes type technology. That's where they are. It's not where they want to be.
Right. Now, one of the things that's taken the biggest hit is their naval units, right? That they've had a hard time keeping them maintained.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another story with the loss of the key people. The problems they have with that new Akula SSN, which they leased to India, the one that had the problem where it killed, what, 20-some people when some guy hit the wrong switch and set off a fire suppression system, which killed most of the people, many people in the compartment. It took them, you know, almost a year to fix that. And that, they admitted, was a leftover from the Soviet days where they were sort of lackadaisical with safety features. American astronauts have come back, you know, when they were up there with a Russian astronaut, and the Russians would admit that they simply have a different attitude, you know, quick and dirty. You know, we'll get it fixed. If it blows up, hey, you know, that's life. They simply work with what they've got. And for a long time during the Soviet period, what they got was not so great.
Right. Austin, we've got some political things happening in Russia, too. Well, you know, there's always political things happening there, but they've changed their constitution now so that a president can be in for 2 6-year terms consecutively. And it looks like Putin is going to run for that. There's a lot of speculation that Putin is actually still in control because he got his people into the positions when he left. I've heard you refer to him as a modern day czar.
Well, that's kind of shorthand or a sound bite. He's not a czar in the literal sense of a royal family. However, he has mastered the art. You said he's got his people in the right places. Remember, he's a former KGB stalwart. He was a member of the KGB, trained in the elite academies, had a very wide political portfolio, really, in political and in intelligence portfolio. So what he's got himself in a situation where he's both a personality, and we've seen all those pictures of Putin with his shirts off. Remember those, Dan?
Yep, I do. Unfortunately,
Jim, remember seeing those? We were chuckling.
He's still got his PR people running it. There was another batch for the summer of 10.
Yeah, I think they had him on a horse or something with his shirt off.
I'm waiting for the calendar. Yeah,
he's a calendar boy, but I mean he's also the macho. He's, and I don't mean this in a literal sense, but I mean this is kind of a Cossack and Khan combination. Both, I mean, you know, I didn't say Genghis Khan, but I mean he's showing how strong he is. He's showing how vital he is. So that's the personality aspect of it. So what he's done is he's not running a totalitarian state like the Soviet Union. That doesn't work. he's not running really a feudalistic regime like the Tsar, but I think in many ways it's more comparable to the way the Tsarist regime would work through personal influence, not ideological commitments per se, but personal influence, money, payoffs, and also the fact that he has a large cadre of personal supporters who are committed to him. So when I say he's a 21st century czar, don't think of something out of the 17th century in any literal sense. But he is in a pragmatic sense, personally influential, has both financial and, well, I'll say military power, and a military extraordinary influence for security forces and through the through the KGB. So you really have a very effective combination of a grand vizier, just to use the Ottoman term, and a prince combined with that. With that, he's got some structural influence as a prime minister. He'll have more as president, but it's a regime built around him, his personal influence, and the ability to also buy or coerce influence. And when I say it's a czar, I think that says more than just saying it's a commissar. He's not out selling an ideology. He's got Russian nationalism, if that's the ideology, a kind of Russian mysticism, and that Russian mysticism plays in, I think, with some of the imagery that we were discussing earlier. It's an appeal to the powerful Russian of the steppes, and occasionally the Russian of the forest, and the like. So he's manipulating that imagery through himself a story of national pride and national resurgence. Yeah. And that's what he's up to. I do see it. Is he a dictator? It's a type of dictator.
Right.
It's not the same thing that we saw during the Cold War. No.
Well, Russia has this history of having strongmen in charge. I mean, if you go back to their origins with the Rus, who were Vikings that came in and started establishing city-states there, it was the strongman coming in. Later on, they have the Mongols coming in and doing some similar things. So they've got that tradition of a strongman.
Well, Dan, the strongman, look, Africa's got the strongman tradition. South America, many, and that's still playing out. Say the tradition, but the point is that he's extremely sophisticated in the way he operates. He's extremely aware of popular imagery and connectivity to Russian history. He definitely, this is where he will pick up on the classic Russian strongman. You know, the attacks from Chechnya and Dagestan. He's committed to that and using the most brutal suppressive means at his disposal, whatever it takes in Dagestan and Chechnya. We're not going to have subways blow up in Moscow. But here's one of the peculiar wrinkles, say, about the 21st century. Is that he wants the economic connectivity to Western Europe. They want the economic connectivity with other Asian nations as well. I mean, China, Iran, even deals with everyone. And the one thing they have not mastered, Jim touched on this, and I don't know that they're going to master it. They got a lot of problems with many of their so-called high-tech high-tech manufacturing. They do have an extraordinary, what's the right way to say this, fallback position. They got a huge mattress to land on, which is they have so many resources, not just petroleum and natural gas, but they've got lumber. And if they could ever get their agricultural sector proper, improve their infrastructure in the agriculture arena, they're a agricultural power. We've seen what's happened when they've had some of their production problems this year. Suddenly the global price of wheat starts to fluctuate because the Russians aren't producing enough.
Right.
They've got all kinds of, they've got all those other natural resources to fall back on. That said, Putin's challenge, let me flip this. I'm talking about the politics to it. The Putin's challenge is to not let Russia fall back into being a natural resources exporter. There's got to be modernization as well with its industries.
Right. Well, one of the problems, Jim, right, is that, you know, we talk about our crumbling infrastructure here in the United States. The Russian infrastructure is already crumbled. It's in
pieces.
Well,
not only that, a lot of the Russian infrastructure, you know, compared to Western countries, never existed. So in many cases, roads, for example, they're starting from scratch. But yes, their public utilities, electrical generation, many cities, they have centralized, you know, steam facilities for producing heat. Everything basically fell apart in the last decade or so of the Soviet Union, and that all has to be rebuilt. Another thing the Russians don't like to publicize too much is that if this global warming proceeds, for whatever reason, Russia will be one of the beneficiaries. They will be one of the main beneficiaries. Because as the heat line, shall we say, moves north, it means a lot more of Russia becomes arable.
Mm-hmm.
So they become the breadbasket of the planet.
Right.
That, them and Canada.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, that brightens their future, as it were.
Right. Now, another thing, Jim, that I always like to talk about when we talk about Russia, because it's so near and dear to my heart, is their sophistication in one of the areas that they have kept up in is not in the development of computers and like that, but in the usage of computers, and that they've got a lot of very talented programmers and computer scientists that sometimes are doing nasty things.
Yes, the companies that could have capitalized on that, I mean, if all these Russian software engineers had been living in Silicon Valley or outside of Boston or in Utah, they would have been hired, you know, to legitimate jobs, you know, very quickly. But the companies were not there, although they are appearing with great rapidity now in the last, you know, 5-10 years, and a lot of them went into illegal pursuits. Now, that is changing a lot. A lot of them are getting arrested. A lot of them are just getting scared. And there are jobs now. For a long time, I even got calls, you know, late 90s, you know, early aughts, from Russian brokers looking to, you know, offering the programming services of people from the Soviet Academy of Sciences. In other words, all the Russian think tanks supported by the Soviet Union, but now basically on their own. A lot of those people have immigrated, not a lot, maybe 10-20%. A lot of them are still there. A lot of them basically got other jobs, and their skills are a bit rusty. But you're right. They have a lot of very bright people who the Soviet educational system funneled, like they did with Olympic athletes, you know, to the best schools. They're well-educated. And, yes, they have depth. They have a bench, as it were.
Right.
And you're going to be seeing more and more, as you probably already detected, you're going to be seeing more and more software breakthroughs coming out of Russia. I think this is one of the reasons why they wanted to make friends on a technology exchange level with Israel, because Israel is the other powerhouse of software development. And a lot of those Israeli software developers are Russian.
Right.
You know, people who either were Jews or pretended they were Jews and got out in the 80s, or their kids. I know the Russians noticed that. And they said, well, let's see if we can get some of that back.
Right. Yeah, one of the interesting things is that they've gone into the games industry there. Some of the companies you see popping up they're able to produce computer games more cheaply than here in the United States, and they actually produce some very good stuff.
Yeah, they've been doing that since the 90s. It took them a while to catch on to the cultural and marketing angles. You know, some Russian games were weird.
Yeah.
because they were, you know, stuck in the Soviet Union for 70 years. You develop strange ideas. But they seem to have, in the last 5 years, 10 years, the last decade, they've basically absorbed, you know, what is going on in the West. And yes, as you have noticed, they can produce a game and people can't tell it was made in Russia.
Right.
You know, it's like Rockstar Games up in Scotland, for crying out loud.
Right.
Producing games of gang life in the United States. Well, the Russians, if the Scots can do it, the Russians do it. Maybe
right.
They even thought that. They said, hey, Rockstar, hey, if they can do it, they have long winters up in Scotland. They drink a lot, just like us. And off they went.
Right. Well, Austin, what is the biggest pain in Russian side right now internationally? What is their biggest threat?
Say again, their biggest, what they perceive as their biggest
threat? Their biggest threat, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure whether we should say this on Strategy Talk or not. I think their biggest concern is China.
Yeah.
It has been. I mean, that's what China has improved dramatically. It's high-tech industries. China is making money. China is modernizing its military forces, and they share that huge, long, extensive border. And China, Chinese nationalists say, you know, parts of Siberia were illegally taken from us by the Tsar. And just because you guys got it a couple of hundred years ago, or in some cases it precedes that, but you don't, doesn't mean you're going to have it forever. Now, that's could be just trash talk out of Beijing, but the Russians don't hear it that way. And remember what I said a few minutes ago, too, about the extraordinarily valuable natural resources that are throughout Siberia.
Right.
Now, they also have a challenge of militant Islamism, as China does, as India does, as we do, as virtually every Muslim country on the planet has a challenge from the militant Islamists. And you see it dramatically portrayed in, talked about it a few minutes ago, subway bombings in Moscow and the brigandage, the attacks on trains and the like from purportedly, and I say, in some cases, it may be purportedly militant Islamist groups. They could also be, that's a good cover for being a bandit and a thug. That's not to say some of the guys that you run into the Caucasus are not, but they are dedicated militant Islamists. So that's another threat. And that's the curious situation, Dan, it depends on how you read it, is a situation of Iran. Russia makes money out of Bushehr. That's the big reactor that they have built for the Iranians. The Iranians have a lot of natural gas, so do the Russians. Together, if they coordinate sales, the theory is they get better prices and the like. But the Iranian regime is no friend of the Russians. They're long-time competitors, long-time enemies. Now the other issue, this is not so much a threat as a tool in my estimation, and that is the issue of the scattered Russian ethnics, Transdniester in Moldova being an example of it, or some of the, again, scattered ethnic groups that claim they would rather be part of Russia than stuck in Georgia or elsewhere. Again, that's not as much as you asked what the threat was, but that is a foreign policy interest, and it's one that the claim that they say that these Russian ethnic groups that are scattered out there are threatened, therefore they have to act to protect them. I take that with many, many grains of salt, but there is a quote-unquote threat component in that.
Yeah. I guess when you mentioned those resources up in Siberia, that seems like it is going to be a headache at some point because the Chinese are going to be running out of resources and they're going to be looking for, you know, resource grabs.
Well, now, Dan, that's one theory, and you're not the first to make that point.
Right.
That's one of the main points on it. But it's, let's just put it this way. There are many, many reasons to not have a war. Like, it could go nuclear. and everybody could make a mistake. And a resource grab would really be short-sighted in what it would could do to everyone's economy. I know that's kind of one of those thrilling headlines. Possibility exists. I don't think it will happen, but I recognize that the possibility exists, and it is disgusting.
Do you think that before the Chinese went for something like that, that their foremost thinking would be to go after Formosa first?
Dan, I in my read on, if we're going to talk about China on this, my read on China is that China needs to avoid border wars.
Okay.
There again, they've got several decades of economic system construction.
Uh-huh.
In order to do that, nevertheless, that's not the way, and we've talked about this before. Nevertheless, they're China's the nations that border China don't see it that way. They see China as the Japanese seeing the Chinese with their fleet, Russians hearing the same smack talk that I mentioned earlier about Siberia. So that's the thing is, as a war damages China's long-term goal of economic, not just economic revitalization, but economic success. I mean, it puts them in a terrible bind. What they make their money on is international trade. The same reason that I said earlier that the Russians, you're not really going to see another Russian czar in the feudalistic sense. Putin is interested in making deals. And that's because that's the isolated economy, whether it's isolated ideologically or isolated because it lacks the infrastructure to be productive, human and physical infrastructure. That's a recipe for poverty.
And, right.
I don't see the Chinese wanting to be poor, and I actually don't see the Russians wanting to be poor.
Right.
So, I just don't see that, and I don't see Putin, to get back to Russia, as a figure who wants an impoverished country.
Right.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah, so, the conflicts that are going to be coming in the future are more economic wars than they are actual physical wars.
You're still going to have the military component of power. But the thing is that the issue, and you're still going to have wars. But the issue is, what is it you're risking if you miscalculate? And
right.
Again, this is why we have a curious situation. I love the way Dunnigan talks about communist China. Yeah, they're communist in a way they try to maintain political control, but that's not a communist country, nor is Russia.
Right.
And as far as we can tell, Cuba, has Castro given up on communism? Was the quote in the Atlantic Monthly accurate? Well, we do know that Havana says they're going to fire 500,000 or pare back 500,000 workers. That's out of a population of 11 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, communism is basically dead except in academia. North Korea, according to South Korean, South Koreans I know, who have visited and visit regularly on business, government, or commercial into North Korea, say it's just turned into a dictatorship. Nobody really pays much attention in the North to, communist dogma. There is North Korean dogma, the Juche and all this stuff, the Kim family invented. And they have basically moved away from any worship of, Karl Marx or anything like that. Same thing in China, as Austin points out. There's no serious study, of communism anymore. And everybody admits that it's basically a one-party dictatorship, which is scrambling to, stay on its feet. Cuba, as Austin was just pointing out, same thing. They may say more about, communism and socialism or what have you, but I think you have more true believers in communist socialism down in Venezuela than you do in Cuba.
Right. So communism is only alive and well at Harvard and Yale.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that... Go ahead.
Actually, you may have. There may
some
be
some people
few,
say in the White House, but that I'm not going
to. Yeah, we. I didn't want to go there either because we try to stay apolitical, but.
Well, but down there, maybe a few out there in Utah with you on some of those faculties. You just have to accept it.
Yeah.
That's just because they haven't caught them yet.
Right, right. Well, I'm sure up at the since I'm a BYU graduate, I'm sure up at the University of Utah there are some. So, but that's
sorry we went there.
Right.
I know those of you who listen to Strategy Page don't like this kind of crosstalk, but there you go.
Right. Anyhow, I think that's a good place to end, and thank you again, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, till next
time. Bye. Bye, Dad.